Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, marking Holocaust Memorial Day, remembering the great Dominican master St. Thomas Aquinas and how the Romans built the Colosseum. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. It's time for me to introduce you to Father Manfred Deselers, a Catholic priest who was born in Germany in 1955, 10 years then after the end of the Second World War. He's a man who, after his ordination to the priesthood back in 1983, has played an active role in Christian-Jewish dialogue. In 1990, he moved to Poland, where he now works as pastor of the German Bishops' Conference at the German, Polish and Christian-Jewish Reconciliation Center for Dialogue and Prayer in the neighborhood of the concentration and extermination camps of Auschwitz-Birkenau. I met him in this bleak place back in May 2006. On the occasion of the historic visit to these camps of Benedict XVI, a fellow German. I myself was in Poland to report on this papal visit for the radio, and I have to admit the encounter with Father Manfred proved to be one of the most moving moments of my week there. He's a gentle and charismatic man who's made it his mission in life to work towards reconciliation through dialogue and prayer. Something he does on one of the scenes of the largest experiment in genocide in the history of humankind. In a few moments, I'll be sharing with you an interview I did with him on that occasion. I've chosen to do this to mark the International Day of Commemoration of the Victims of the Holocaust, which falls each year on the 27th of January, a date which coincides with that day back in 1945, when the inmates of the concentration and extermination camps of Auschwitz-Birkenau, those who still could, walked to freedom. I thought it would be a fitting moment to shine the spotlight on a man who has worked hard at the Reconciliation Center for Dialogue and Prayer for so many years. One who, as a matter of interest, in the year 2000, was awarded the title of Man of Reconciliation by the Polish Council of Christians and Jews. Father Manfred, can I ask you a very personal question? Why do you work here at Auschwitz?
It's hard to answer it shortly. In my biography, there were times when I touched the issue of Auschwitz. The first time it was after finishing high school. I decided to do civil service with an action service of Peace in Germany, an organization which is engaged in reconciliation work after World War II. And with them I spent one and a half a year in Israel. And preparing to this time and work in Israel, we also were here in Auschwitz. This was in 73. Being here for the first time, I was very much moved and touched and, in a sense, shocked about what my people, the German people, has done. And I understood that being normal is not normal, and it means a great responsibility. A great responsibility for peace and reconciliation. 2 years later, I decided to study theology and become a priest, and the service for reconciliation for me still is one of the main issues.
You said you came here because of the shock you felt. I think what shocked me this morning, I saw Auschwitz for the first time, was the sheer scale of it and the systematic elimination that took place here. What struck you?
The scale of loss of feeling of dignity of person. People were treated as material. They were used as working labor, but they had no dignity, which was respected. Once I talked with a survivor, a Jewish person, and she asked me, "What do you want me to do here?" And I answered, in a sense, "I want to give you back your dignity." And she said to me, "Oh, Manfred, you don't have to give me back my dignity. I did never lose it. You have lost it." Which means, of course, not personally, I lived not in that time, but those who were responsible for what happened here lost the conscience, the faith, the feeling of human dignity.
You spoke about those who were responsible. So you still feel a common guilt all these years later, 61 years have gone by, as a German?
All the survivors say me, "Manfred, you are not guilty," because I'm born many years later. I don't feel that all the Germans now living are guilty, but someone did what happened, and there is a guilt, and this is connected with the German people. And it's not possible to escape it. But it's changing into responsibility. I have to know what wounds have been caused in other people, in other nations, and they are still wounds. And this, for me, means a responsibility to try to build bridges, new bridges, to enforce existing bridges, which have to be human bridges. Bridges from heart to heart, bridges of trust. I cannot be here just as a human person, not being seen as a human person from Germany. And this has a dimension of special responsibility.
You stress that word, responsibility, as someone who's born in Germany. Clearly Benedict XVI comes here as Pope, but we can't ignore the fact that he too is German, no?
No, first of all, he comes here as a Pope. He is not representing the German people, he is representing the Catholic Church. But of course it has a meaning that he is German, like it had a meaning that John Paul II was Polish. John Paul II was born here, not far from here. So when he came here from a very personal feeling of obligation, and also he had been bishop in this area. Benedict has a totally different background. But in this time of history, he said himself, maybe it's a sign of providence that after the Polish Pope, there's a German Pope. And coming here, he certainly shows that the memory of Auschwitz and the wound of Auschwitz is something important for the Church, at least in this given time of history. And he feels he should come here to pray, to honor the victims, to show the world and his German people and the Church that it is important to remember, important with this memory, do whatever we can for peace and understanding among nations and religions.
How does one pray in a place where so much evil has been perpetrated? I mean, where was God?
I think here you always begin with silence, not with words. With silence and listening. Listening to the voice of this earth, listening to the memories of the victims, and looking for God, searching God. For us Christians, the memory of Jesus on the cross with the cry, my God, why have you abandoned me, is very important. So it helps to believe that those who died here were not abandoned by God. But for me, it's in a sense easy to say, so I was not here in those times. But there are testimonies of those who survived, even of those who died here. Such testimonies of people losing their faith and testimonies of people who died with their faith, Christian and Jewish. For me, personally, the main important aspect is the memory, the belief that those who died here were loved by God. They had a dignity which God gave them. And the murderers could not take it in the end. So God was on their side and not on the murder side.
So Hitler didn't have the final word?
He did not. And I believe deeply that God has the last word, and God is love.
There go to Father Manfred Desselers, pastor of the German Bishops' Conference, who lives and works at the Center for Dialogue and Prayer, situated at the heart of the concentration and extermination camps of Auschwitz-Birkenau. And now, on a totally different note, I'd like to mark the feast of the great Dominican master, St. Thomas Aquinas, which falls each year on the 28th of January. I'll be doing this by joining Jill Bevilacqua as she brings us a programme focusing on his life and work.
Barely half a century after the death of Thomas Aquinas, Pope John XXII declared him a canonized saint and paid him the greatest tribute one could offer a teacher of doctrine.
Thomas, he said, has illumined the church more than all the other doctors, and a man will gain more profit from spending a year studying his books than a lifetime studying the doctrines of others.
Men have been studying Thomas ever since. Young men training for the priesthood are still required to study his writings.
Of his two greatest works, the Summa Contra Gentiles and the Summa Theologica, the second is considered the classic scientific exposition of theology and earned for its author the name of the Universal Teacher. It's been likened to a great cathedral, solidly built on unshakable foundations and splendid with tall, shining pinnacles. At the Council of Trent, it was placed next to the Bible.
Thomas Aquinas was born around the year 1225 in his father's castle, perched on the summit of a great crag at Rocca Secca, not far from the Benedictine monastery of Monte Cassino.
Count Landulf of Aquino sent his youngest son to school under the Benedictines when he was 5 years old, and there he stayed until he was 14.
Thomas was a large, heavy child and unusually quiet. His only recorded remark was a question he put to one of his teachers. "What is God?" he exploded one day. We are not told what answer he was given, but Thomas was to take the matter into his own hands.
Not knowing quite what to do with his rather dreamy son, Landulf decided to make a monk of him and proposed him as abbot of the monastery. But he had reckoned without Thomas himself.
At Naples University, he'd come under the influence of the Dominicans, and at the age of 17, he announced that he had joined the begging friars. The family reacted violently, and as Thomas was on his way to Rome, heading eventually for Paris, his brothers waylaid him, dragged him off to the castle, and locked him in a tower. It was not until a year later that Thomas, with the help of his sister, eventually made his escape.
Thomas made his way to Cologne, and there studied under Albert the Great, who soon recognized the intellectual strength of the young man and made a famous prophecy. Thomas had been dubbed the dumb ox by his fellow students for his lack of participation in the debates. "You call him a dumb ox," said Albert. "I tell you that the dumb ox will bellow so loud that his bellowing will fill the world."
When Albert was called to Paris to receive the degree of a doctor, he took Thomas with him. They travelled like any other friars, sleeping in whatever monasteries they found, till they came to that of St. James in Paris.
Here Thomas met another friar, the Franciscan Bonaventure, who was to become such a close friend that the two were likened to David and Jonathan.
In Paris, Thomas received his degree of Bachelor of Theology, and about 1248 returned to Cologne with Albert as second lecturer. But when a controversy between the University of Paris and the teaching friars broke out, Thomas threw himself into the defence with such zeal that he was chosen to defend the attitude of the Dominicans before the Pope himself.
So he and Bonaventure went up to Rome together to defend the freedom of the friars. But the hostility of the university to the mendicant orders was such that the two did not receive their doctorate in theology until 1257.
Another battle from which Thomas emerged triumphant was in the rehabilitation of Aristotle. Here it's been said he was fighting on two fronts: to defend the faith against the abuse of Aristotle by supporting the use of Aristotle. St. Thomas, says one writer, did not reconcile Christ to Aristotle, he reconciled Aristotle to Christ.
The end of human life is happiness, and so different lives have different kinds of happiness. For whoever is not engaged in public life cannot attain the happiness of a public career, which provides the best in civic life. It likewise follows that whoever arrives at contemplative happiness must become a participator in contemplative life. Whence, the happiness that man can attain naturally is in accord with human life. But because there is promised to us a certain happiness in which we shall be equal to the angels, and this not only exceeds the powers of man, but even of the angels who are brought to this by grace, just as we are, and because this is natural only to God, it is therefore likewise fitting that man should arrive at that divine happiness, because he has become a participant in divine life. But it is especially friendship that makes one man associate with another. And so, some men hunt together, some drink together, and some philosophize together, etc. And therefore, it was natural to believe in a kind of friendship with God by which we might enjoy his company. And this is charity.
Thomas Aquinas has been called one of the great liberators of the human intellect, lover of truth, a positive thinker who believed that life was worth living. He has been called not only a scholar saint, but a saint of the secular.
The philosophy of the time was one of signs and symbols, bypassing this world and heading straight for the next. Thomas, on the other hand, saw the sacred value of time, of this world. He managed to unite the values of this world with those of the next.
His was a philosophy of reality. He believed that man should be studied in his whole manhood. Christians were supposed to concern themselves with souls, not with men.
But for Thomas, a man was not a man without his body, any more than he was not a man without his soul. He asserted that man's body is his body, as his mind is his mind, and that he can only be a balance and union of the two.
The traditional image of Thomas Aquinas is that of the intellectual, so absorbed in thought that he would be unaware of the candle burning his fingers. When he was not sitting still reading, Thomas would walk rapidly round the cloisters, and although he would be polite to anyone who stopped and interrupted him, he would walk even faster when left alone once more.
What is often passed over is the holiness of the man. Thomas was a very private person, and about this he was more private than about anything else. He loved the poor to the extent that he was a nuisance to the rich, and like Francis of Assisi, embarrassed his family by his generosity. When he embraced poverty himself, he did so absolutely, and all through his life refused any kind of ecclesiastical honour.
O ineffable Creator, who has wisely appointed 9 choirs of angels, setting them above the heavens in marvellous order, who has wonderfully established the parts of the universe, who is the fountain of light and wisdom, the first cause, shed upon the darkness of my mind the light of your love, and remove from me the twofold darkness of sin and ignorance in which I was born. You, who make eloquent the tongues of babes, instruct my tongue. Pour the grace of your blessing upon my lips. Give keenness in understanding, retention in memory, facility in preaching and interpreting sublime realities, and a wide vocabulary as well. Inspire my beginning, direct my progress, bring all to an end. You, who art true God and man, who livest and reignest one God, world without end. Amen.
When Thomas was asked by some of the other doctors at the Sorbonne about the nature of the mystical change in the elements of the Blessed Sacrament, he felt the need for more spiritual guidance than usual. He prayed long before the Blessed Sacrament, and at last threw down his thesis at the foot of the crucifix on the altar.
When he returned to prayer, an extraordinary thing happened, witnessed by the other friars, who recounted it afterwards. The figure of Christ came down from the altar, and stood on the scroll, saying, Thomas, you have written well concerning the sacrament of my body. And then, said the friars, Thomas was borne up miraculously in mid-air.
After the controversy on the Blessed Sacrament, to which Thomas had contributed his scroll, Pope Urban IV instituted the Feast of Corpus Christi in 1264. The story goes that it was Thomas who had urged the Pope to establish such a feast. He had offered Thomas a cardinal's hat, and Thomas had characteristically refused. He was told then to ask for anything else he wished, so long as it was within the Pope's power. Thomas asked for a feast to celebrate Christ's presence in the Blessed Sacrament. The Pope complied, inviting Thomas to compose the office for the new feast.
Thomas Aquinas lived 49 years, and in that time he wrote, it is recorded, 10,870,000 words. But on December the 6th, 1273, he laid down his pen, saying, I can write no more. When his friend, Brother Reginald, ventured to suggest that he return to his reading and writing, Thomas answered with even more emphasis, I cannot. Such things have been revealed to me that all I have written seems to me to be so much straw.
In 1274, Pope Gregory X asked Thomas to attend the Council of Lyon, which aimed at reunion with the Greek Church. Thomas, who was nearing 50 years of age, was not well, but he obeyed and set out on the journey. He was taken ill when at his sister's house and was removed to the nearby Cistercian monastery at Fossa Nova, and there he died while listening to the Canticle of Canticles. It was March 1274.
Thomas Aquinas has been given many titles, but that of the Eucharistic Doctor is perhaps the most valid. Thomas approached the Blessed Sacrament whenever he had a problem on his mind, and on his deathbed he made this profession of faith.
If in this world there be any knowledge of this mystery keener than that of faith, I wish now to use it to affirm that I believe in the real presence of Jesus Christ in this sacrament. Truly God and truly man, the Son of God, the Son of the Virgin Mary. This I believe and hold for true and certain.
And the warmest of thanks to Jill Bevilacqua in this programme produced by Sean Patrick Lovett. Finally, you may have just heard the Colosseum is to be restored by the founder of Todd's luxury shoe brand, Diego della Valle. Good news then, as this businessman is said to rescue a monument that represents Italy in the world. A restoration which will certainly no longer use Roman numerals in the calculation process, and presumably no longer the iron pins that hold it together. I once went there with a man who knows all things Roman, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster. So why don't you join me there as we take a look around on a very windy day, as you'll hear in my microphone in a moment. Everybody's familiar with the structure of this building, but I think one of the things that people don't know is why it's so pitted with holes.
Well, okay, what you have here, what we see here, is what the barbarians did, namely this whole Colosseum. Even today, as we stand here, the whole Colosseum is held together by iron pins. So the blocks were put on top of each other, and in the four corners of the blocks, there were iron pins. It's not cement, because that would have gone down a long time ago. But, and so when the barbarians came, they knew they could get ready-made iron, you see.
Which was a precious, which was very precious in those days.
They didn't know how to do this. The 9th century, the Middle Ages. And so they went here, and you see where all the holes are, is exactly where the blocks meet. And so they went in there and pulled out these iron pins. So you have the whole facade here and outside. The inside, you still have iron pins holding the blocks together. And they have so many calculations, about 20 tons or whatever, 10,000 tons or something of iron. 20 tons of iron here to hold the Colosseum together. That's why you have the holes. Some people say because there was marble on the outside, but that's really not true if you look, because all the holes are right in the corners where they knew they could get the iron pins, you see.
Very interesting.
There are all kinds of stories about there being bronze shields and a bronze cupola on the Colosseum.
No, I'm going to say the bronze up on top. What they had up on top, you can see, even from here, there are small ledges.
If you look upwards at the top level, on the fourth level.
You can see two ledges right there sticking out. What they did have was poles, wooden poles on those ledges. And this went all around. It looked like toothpicks on the top of the Colosseum. And reconstructions of the Colosseum today have these like toothpicks up on top. And they had a special system of ropes with winches, and these ropes, they could pull together an awning, a cloth awning out over the spectators and...
protect them from the sun.
The sun and the weather, the rain. It couldn't hold the whole roof. It wasn't like an astrodome. It wasn't a closed thing. And the fact is it would rain right through the middle onto the floor. And that's another story I always tell here, because the floor was wooden in here and covered with sand. And the sand was cleared out after all these games to clear out all the mess and the gore, etc., etc. And the word in Latin for sand is arena. And so in English you have arena, because in Latin the floor of the Colosseum was covered with sand. No one knows that. So to go out in the arenam, to go out onto the sand, is to go into the middle of the Colosseum for the games or some battle or something here. And they said it took 3 months to dedicate this Colosseum. About 3,000 different animals were killed around here. Rhinoceroses, all that other stuff, lions and elephants and stuff from North Africa. And we have a famous Latin poet, Martialis, who describes the games used for the celebration, some horrible things. When we go here with the students, I tell them the Colosseum is a monument to Roman architecture, but it's not a monument to Roman civilization.
And to Christianity?
No, neither. I'll tell you why. Because what went on there was really no credit to anyone. Gory, terrible games. And killing of animals and animals and people and people and all the most horrible things you can think of went on in the Colosseum for the delight of the people. By the way, this also went on after Christianity was established. It went for about another century, and after there was one day, there was a monk, a famous monk, who jumped into the middle of the Colosseum and said, let's stop all this terrible bloodiness, and that's when the whole thing was stopped. But it went into Christian times too. Big story is all the Christians killed in the Colosseum, which most historians today would kind of, well, I discredit, you know.
So it's a myth.
Well, they would say maybe one or two or three who got caught up in the shuffle of the Colosseum.
Heartfelt thanks there once again to Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, better known as our popular Latin lover. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I am Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now. Laudetur, Jesus Christus.